The Tom Woods Show, episode 1471.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you believe in homeschooling, but you also believe in not running yourself ragged and in maintaining your mental health, then you need the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum, for which I made 400 videos on history and government. Get it from me, and I'll throw in three exclusive, unbelievable bonuses you can't get anywhere else. How do you get it through me? Head over to ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. A bit off the beaten path today with our subject matter, but I think you're really going to like it. And my guests are two libertarians, both of whom have been guests on the program in the past. The first is Michael Edelstein, and the second, David Ramsey Steele. Michael Edelstein is a clinical psychologist in private practice in San Francisco, and David Ramsey Steele is a writer, public speaker, debater, editor, and classical liberal. He's the author of, among other books, From Marx to Mises, Post-Capitalist Society and the Challenge of Economic Calculation. Today we're going to be talking about their book, a book they worked on together, and it's called 3-Minute Therapy, Change Your Thinking, Change Your Life. So instead of saying welcome to the show, then they'll be talking over each other, I think I'm just going to dive right into the questions. All right, let's begin with what would seem to be the most obvious question. What, in fact, does 3-minute therapy amount to? What is the process? What are you trying to accomplish by using it, this approach?
Okay, well, there's two questions in there, Tom. There's the method and what we're trying to accomplish. So starting with the second part, we're trying to teach people a method that enables them, in essence, to be their own therapist, to identify emotional and behavioral problems such as anxiety, depression, anger, addictions, procrastination, and identify what's causing it, where these problems are coming from, and it's a philosophical base, and then teach them ways to question, challenge, and contradict their irrational ideas that go against reality that cause their emotional disturbance, so they can develop a new, more functional philosophy. That's our goal. And the method is loosely based on the scientific method, identifying your irrational ideas, and we can get more into what they are, and then overturning them with a new, more functional philosophy.
So that lays out what the approach is. And as you go through this book, and you see how it applies in a variety of different situations, a variety of different struggles people might find themselves in, anything from excessive drinking to procrastination to depression. You see how the method applies. And what I also like about the book is you give examples, obviously not using people's names, but from your career, of people who it took a little while for them to get the hang of the method because they had such self-doubt that they would be constantly second-guessing themselves, or when they would try to put down the thoughts that were discouraging them from doing the things that would lead them to having a flourishing life, there would be a voice, not obviously not a literal voice in their heads, but there'd be a voice telling them about, you know, 10 reasons why this can't work, 10 reasons why you're bound to be a failure forever. And sometimes they would get stymied with that, and you would show how you worked through with them and showed them these are all false ideas and you have to confront them. So I wonder if we could take an example, because you have many chapters here where you walk through a particular person or a particular kind of scenario in which a lot of people find themselves, and you apply the 3-minute therapy to that situation.
Yeah. So an example is based on the what's called the ABC model in this kind of therapy. By the way, it's called rational emotive behavior therapy and was devised by a genius named Albert Ellis in the 1950s. So A is an activating event. Say, I was fired. And then we skip B for a minute. C is emotional consequence. I'm depressed. So I was fired and now I'm depressed. Now B, which is a major part of this, is irrational belief. If you're depressed, if you have emotional disturbance, that's because your thinking goes against reality in some way. So a typical B here would be, because I prefer not to have been fired, I prefer to have a job and pay my rent. Therefore, I absolutely must not be fired. I must have a continual job. And this proves I'm a total loser because I no longer have a job. So that's the irrational belief. And you'll notice the form of that. It's taking a preference. We all have preferences to achieve our goals. And being an imperfect human, escalating them into demands. Must, should, supposed tos, have tos. So the structure is, I prefer to have X, therefore I absolutely must have X. I'm no good, I'm a failure. And that leads to emotional disturbance. Then, so that's the diagnostic part of the exercise. And we call it 3-minute exercise in the book. And then there's D, E, and F. We have A, B, and C, then there's D, E, and F. D is where the scientific method comes in, disputing, questioning, or challenging the irrational belief. So a typical way to do that is just saying, what's the evidence? What's the evidence? I must not get fired. Where is that written? Where is it etched in stone? And then we go on to E to answer the question, effective new thinking or effective new philosophy. And there are many reasons why the must is false. So we could answer the question by saying, although I prefer not to get fired, there's no reason I must not. Since I'm an imperfect human who screws up at times, of course, firing is an option. Yeah, I don't like being fired, but it's hardly the end of my world. I can stand this difficult situation, although I don't like it. I can still have a happy life, even though I don't keep my job forever, although I'd probably be much happier if I did. And the more you remind yourself about why the must is false, the more persuasive it tends to be. And then that leads to the final line there, F, new feeling. So this isn't feel-good therapy where the new feeling would be I'm happy or I'm content or fulfilled or things like that. It still would be a negative emotion, but an appropriate functional negative emotion such as deep concern, great regret, major disappointment, rather than these emotions like depression or anxiety that eat you up inside, and also emotions that lead you and motivate you to try to work hard to achieve your goal, start going for interviews or do research on other jobs, etc. So that's the basic method.
As a follow-up to that, let me ask, a lot of people think that the experiences that we've had in childhood help to determine where we are now in terms of our, you know, our well-being from a mental health standpoint. And this method implicitly, and then at one point in the book, quite explicitly, denies that. So what's wrong with being concerned about, let's say, traumatic experiences from childhood? And why are they not to blame, basically, for the conundrums we find ourselves in?
I think this is one of the great myths of our age, and we constantly find it in movies and other aspects of popular culture, which is that our mental and psychological and emotional problems can be traced to traumatic events in childhood. And this ultimately is due to the influence of Sigmund Freud. Now, it may be that, it may possibly be, although the evidence is against it, that some of these current problems started with events in childhood. But what we emphasize in the book is that it's the way we think now that causes our problems. It's not a matter of the history where you don't have to go back and relive what happened to you when you were 5 years old and your mummy hit you or something like that. That's completely irrelevant. And in fact, it can be harmful to wallow in these supposed memories of what happened to you in childhood.
And to add to that, I would make another point here that actually, let's suppose you have a fear of rejection. So you don't ask someone for a date, I would say that really didn't start in your childhood. It started when you were born because all humans have the human tendency to escalate their preferences into demand. So normally you'd start with, I prefer not to be rejected by this man or woman, and therefore I must not be rejected. And if I'm rejected, it would be the end of the world. So I'm very anxious about approaching her. And so then I avoid it. So really, we all have this human tendency to escalate preferences into demands, and it's just because we're human, that's a human tendency, and that's the bottom line. Actually, the bottom line might be our genes, et cetera, but it's a human tendency to do that.
Let's say a little something about a topic that you and I, Dr. Edelstein, talked about in a previous episode a long time ago, namely self-esteem and positive thinking. And that people have the right attitude, that this will be helpful for them. Is there anything to that thinking, or is that completely flawed? How do you look at that?
Well, I think the thing to that thinking, and mainly there's not, but one thing is that if you think, if you put yourself up, if you rate yourself highly because you do well or people like you, that gives you positive self-esteem, high self-esteem, and you might feel good for the moment, but generally you would get anxious because you think, I have to maintain my good standing in society, and if I don't, I'm no good. So it leads people to dwell on proving themselves rather than enjoying themselves and accomplishing things in life. So that's one of the major problems. But the underlying philosophical problem with high or low self-esteem is it's correct to rate or judge your actions based on your goals and whether they're helping you achieve your goals. So I was rehired, and that's good in terms of my goals. And then overgeneralizing and rating yourself as a total person, therefore, because I did well on the job market, therefore I'm a well or good person. That's false. It's just your behavior, not the entire you. Humans are a process, always changing, much more complicated than a behavior or pattern of behaviors.
So in fact, there is a problem with low self-esteem, but the solution is not to raise your self-esteem, but to just stop rating yourself. So stop giving yourself a score as a total person.
Let's talk about depression. I've known people who have really, really struggled with it. And you have a chapter in here on how to apply 3-minute therapy to people suffering from depression. And I have to say, I went into this chapter a bit skeptical because I thought it just seems so intractable and it seems insurmountable for some people. Could it really be that 3-minute therapy works for them? And so I want to talk about that, how you use that therapy in that situation. And then in tandem with that, does this therapy work in tandem with, in opposition to, or in strict neutrality with regard to antidepressants and medication?
To take the second part first, I have clients who just want therapy. They don't want to take any pills. I have spoken to other people who don't want therapy. They want to take pills because antidepressants do help some people some of the time for some period of time. And then I have clients who are on antidepressants or anti-anxiety medication, plus the 3-minute therapy, the rational motive behavior therapy. So it could work in tandem or not, depends on the person's proclivities. And then in terms of how you help someone with depression, the nice thing about this rational motive behavior therapy approach is that it starts with some basic principles, which your thinking causes your emotions, not situations themselves. And it applies to all these common problems people have. So with depression, it's also your thinking that's causing your depression. No matter how bad your life is, it's impossible to be depressed without thinking and evaluating your situation. And then it shows you how to identify the irrational beliefs. There are some demands in your head that cause you depression, whether you think it's intractable, or sometimes people call that clinical depression or mild depression. It's the same way that people are depressed. They're thinking. So we identify your musts and shoulds, such as the ones I gave earlier, or it could be another area of musts and shoulds, not a demand on oneself, which was the earlier example, but a demand on the conditions of your life. I must not have one hassle after another. This is awful. And that's called depression also. That's discomfort depression or frustration depression rather than ego depression. And then the approach to overcoming that is the same: questioning, challenging, contradicting your musts. There are no musts. There are no shoulds. We invent them in our head, and uprooting them, disabusing yourself of musts and shoulds, getting in touch with your preferences and working toward your preferences if they're workable, or just accepting the fact that you're not going to achieve what you want, go on to something else.
Right. I think what lies behind Tom's question, I would put it this way. If you receive a piece of very bad news, that's going to affect your brain chemistry. The problem is when people think that your emotions are caused by your brain chemistry, when in fact your thinking and feeling does affect your brain chemistry. There's a two-way interaction. So the idea that is very popular, that the only way to treat things like depression is with modifying the neurotransmitters in your brain, I think is based on a big misunderstanding, because the internal world that we all have of thoughts and feelings has a life of its own, and it can itself affect the brain chemistry. So we shouldn't look for the only solution to problems like depression in the chemistry of the brain.
All right, I'd like to see how we can talk about alcoholism in connection with three-minute therapy and a couple of other things about the way you conceive of alcoholism as compared to the way we see it talked about in popular culture. But before we do that, I have a quick message for the folks. I've got a lot of people who listen to this program who are just burned out. They're burned out by work. They're burned out by parenting. Whatever it is, they're just overwhelmed. And they feel like they can't catch up and they can't catch their breath and their mental health is suffering and their physical health is suffering and they just don't see a way out. Now, I have a potential solution that may be outside your comfort zone, but I want you to try it anyway. And that's the Simple Habit Meditation app. It's a 2018 Google Play Award winner for standout well-being app. It's got over 65,000 five-star reviews, and it's just what you want. It's got short meditations you can consume in 5 minutes. You can be doing them on the go, so you don't have to set aside 45 minutes and sit in a lotus position. Hundreds of meditations are available for free, and thousands with the premium membership. Well, you head over to simplehabit.com/woods and you can get 30% off the premium subscription. That's an amazing deal. Simplehabit.com/woods gets you 30% off the premium subscription. Again, I know this may be outside your comfort zone, but if that voice in your head is telling you you need this, then you need it. Check it out, simplehabit.com/woods. Oh, how about alcoholism? First of all, I'd be curious about what Dr. Elstein has to say about the disease model of alcoholism. Is it correct to describe it as a disease? Secondly, what do you think about 12-step programs? So you have to take these down, right? I got a series of questions. Is alcoholism a disease? Secondly, what's your opinion of 12-step programs? Thirdly, how do you apply three-minute therapy to it?
Okay. As far as the disease model, which is a popular idea with AA and the 12 steps, one of the main differences between depression or emotions and a disease is you can't decide, let's suppose you have the flu and you have symptoms, you can't decide by changing your thinking, I'm not going to have the flu anymore. That doesn't work. Whereas if you have a problem like alcoholism, since compulsive alcohol drinking comes from your thinking, when you change your thinking, then you change your behavior. So changing your thinking doesn't work with disease, but it does work with cognitive processes which cause addictions. David, did you want to take Tom's question on the 12-step model?
Well, I mean, I think that as we point out in the book, the 12-step model has its roots in a religious way of thinking. And a part of the of Alcoholics Anonymous is that you accept that you are powerless to control your life or your thoughts or your emotions, and that you have to put your trust in a higher power. And I think that this is a mistake. I would also say that it's interesting that a lot of the people who promotes the disease model of these emotional problems, they ultimately will accept that the solution is to change people's motivations. So this is a strange kind of disease, you know. It would be very odd to say you have diabetes or cancer or something like that, and then say, well, let's look at your motivations. That would be more or less irrelevant. But in the case of emotional and behavioral problems like alcoholism, everybody accepts in practice who has to deal with alcoholics or other addicts that motivation has to be changed.
Yes. And then your third question, Tom, was how three-minute therapy or rational motor behavior therapy would help people with addictions. And again, it's the same basic structure. What you're thinking, what are you telling yourself to cause you to drink compulsively? And usually it could be a whole host of things, but one of the main categories is dealing with some type of discomfort. So people drink to medicate themselves. They're anxious or depressed, and drinking tends to take away those feelings momentarily, or they're very frustrated, or they have a craving or an urge to drink. So all these would be A, activating event. I have a craving to drink. I have the urge to drink. Then B, again, we're looking for the demand, the must. I must satisfy my craving. I must not feel so uncomfortable, so I'm going to drink. Then C, undesirable behavioral consequences, drinking. And then again, D, disputing or questioning the irrational belief. What's the evidence that because I would like to satisfy my urge, therefore I absolutely must? And the answer is the same. There are no musts, just preferences. At E, effective new thinking, I prefer to satisfy my urge right now, but I don't have to. I can choose to drink or choose not to drink. In order to get long-term benefits, it means putting up with immediate discomfort. And it's not the urge that forces me to drink. Rather, it's my irrational must thinking about it. And I can change my thinking and learn to unconditionally accept discomfort in my life and work toward eliminating it in more functional, long-term ways. And that would lead to F, new behavior, not new feeling in this case, but new behavior. So you could engage in a competing behavior, listen to a Tom Woods interview, or go for a walk, call a friend, go to sleep, have a meal, or you can just do nothing. You can just face the urge, observe it, let it pass, which it will, and not drink. So that's a typical three-minute exercise with addiction.
And one of the things we point out in the book is that there is something called low frustration tolerance, that a lot of people, they just think it's, they assume that it's unthinkable and outrageous that they should have to have any amount of discomfort. So if the choice is between, and having a couple of drinks may make you feel better in the sense that a certain type of discomfort goes away for a while. But this is part of this crooked thinking that we're trying to attack. You know, there is no law of nature that says that you shouldn't put up with a certain amount of discomfort. And sometimes that's the best thing to do. So one of the messages of the book is you're tougher than that. You can stand a little bit of discomfort. This is something that runs through the book.
I want to raise an objection that I'm sure you've heard many times before. People hear what you're saying, and they say the trouble with this approach is that it's how little human beings ultimately are driven by reason. I mean, what you're describing a rational approach, but you know, we've heard it said reason is a slave of the passions. People want to do what they want to do, and they'll use reason to come up with ways they can achieve their goals. But in terms of deciding what the goals are, well, that's decided on the level of the passions, or just simply that it's expecting too much of human nature, what you're describing. How do you answer that?
I'm a great admirer of David Hume, so I would defend the proposition that reason is the slave of the passions. But it's a question of using your reason to gratify all your passions in the most effective manner.
Yeah, Another way to put that is people have ultimate goals and values, and those are the passions, I guess. And then, as David says, then we use reason, or we try to use reason, to achieve those ultimate goals or values. And I don't think you could prove anyone's ultimate goal or value is right or wrong, but you can prove the means toward that end are effective or less effective.
I want to read, as we come to a close here, because I do think people should read this book, 3-Minute Therapy. I was telling you both before we started recording that I read a lot of books for this show, and very rarely am I so impressed, and so rarely do I find something so compelling that I actually get up from where I'm sitting, get an electronic device, and contact somebody and say, you need to read this book. But that is exactly what I did this very morning as I was wrapping up and getting ready for this. I wrote to somebody and said, I think you need to read this. And of course, we're just scratching the surface in this conversation here, but I want to read an objection you have toward the end. In effect, a series of possible objections, or perhaps objections people have really raised against what you're saying, and your responses. And this one really struck me because I could imagine being in this situation. The person says, 3-Minute Therapy says that feelings come from thinking, and undesirable feelings can be eliminated by changing one's thinking. But this can't be true. For example, I feel terribly hurt because Terry, the person I love, has rejected me. I know there's no reason to think I need Terry's love. I'm fully aware that I don't become a worthless person if Terry rejects me. I have no illusions, yet I still feel awful. Now, how do you respond to that?
Well, the way to get from level one thinking, which is superficially recognizing that the needs and musts and absolutes are false, to a deep conviction, deeply feeling it, believing it, and acting on it, the bridge between level one and level two is the same bridge that we use to learn most things, and that's practice, reinforcement, repetition, going over this kind of thinking, the rational thinking, again and again and again, thinking it through, questioning your musts and shoulds when they arise, and with practice, then they begin to sink into your brain.
I hope that's the answer we gave in the book, following that passage. Otherwise, we'll be in trouble.
Actually, yeah, it is. And we gave an example that if you're beside a swimming pool and you watch people jump off the high diving board, you think, oh, that looks like fun. I think I'm going to do it. Then you get up on the high diving board, look down, and you get very nervous. Why is that? You weren't nervous in the first situation, but you are in the second. And that's because in the second situation, you much more strongly reinforce the idea that I must have a guarantee I'm not going to be hurt. This will be awful if it's painful, etc. And the way to get from level one, again, lying by the side of the pool and jumping off the high diving board, is by practice and repetition. Jumping off, pushing yourself to jump off, and show yourself behaviorally the world didn't end and you survived quite well. And the more you do it and do it again, then you have a new perspective in your brain that guides your emotions and behaviors.
I'm looking, as we wrap up, I'm looking at the table of contents here. And you deal with and show the applicability of the 3-minute therapy method to such difficulties as panic attacks, compulsive drinking, anger, procrastination, depression, worry and anxiety, social anxiety, overeating and smoking, and so on. Now, let's suppose we have somebody out there who just does not struggle with any of these things. Is there still a good reason for that person to read 3-minute therapy?
Well, I think there are a few good reasons. One is, once they understand the method, they can help others. And if they're totally rational, they can help, their friends, relatives, and things like that. They can teach them the method. And you don't have to be a PhD licensed psychologist to help people with this approach. It's basically common sense. And also, if they learn the method, then they can help themselves in the future if something happens that they make themselves depressed or anxious about, or they start acting addictively, so they could use it prophylactically. And then it's just a good read. And so that's another reason just for enjoyment.
Yeah, it's a pretty entertaining book. you know, from the point of view of analyzing how people react in specific situations.
I enjoyed it thoroughly. And I think, and as I look through the chapter titles, I can see a couple things that I could probably stand to work on. But I didn't read only those. I read all of them because I know a lot of people. I know people who are in every single one of the situations you describe. And to see the way you apply this theory relentlessly, or this this approach to therapy, it made me feel good that there is a way for people to reorient their thinking in healthy and productive ways that they probably have not considered before. And the complimentary blurbs that you see on the back cover of virtually all books are particularly merited here. At least I can say from the point of view of an amateur. Well, gentlemen, I appreciate your time very much. The book is 3-Minute Therapy, Change Your Thinking, Change Your Life. We'll link to it on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1471. And I appreciate your time.
Well, thanks for having us on.
Thanks. Great interview, Tom. I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
All right, folks, that's it. Remember, it's that time of year again. It's time to think about your homeschooling curriculum. And remember, if you join the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum, not only do you maintain your mental health because you're not running yourself ragged anymore as a parent, but if you use my special link, you also get really, really juicy free bonuses that you don't get anywhere else. My special link is ronpaulhomeschool.com, so go check that out, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.